Seggy alcoholic.
Seggy.
Good evening, everyone. Very happy to see some homies from Rockridge here. Brian and Stephanie. So I'm originally from South Africa, and I grew up in a community where there's a lot of alcoholism, and in fact, my uncles, I saw two effects of alcohol on my immediate relatives. I had uncles who got very violent and beat my aunties, and then I had one uncle who got very gentle, and so I grew up with that atmosphere. I had a high school teacher who would, my first year in high school, I was 14, this teacher would show up, busted lips, eyebrows, you know, a math teacher. And he came out number two in the country in a spelling bee, like they have spelling bee, they have math contests. He would be, that's the one contest we could compete with white people, because we were all separate, you know, during apartheid. And he would be number two in the country. He was like a genius, but he would come drunk. And they never fired him because he was so good. If he could stand up and hold the chalk on the board, and all his students did well. So anyway, to fast forward, I was introduced to alcohol in England, and had a cousin who introduced me to Guinness and Plowman's Lunch in the pubs in London. And that cousin of mine died at 50 years old from alcoholism. And so I started my drinking at 12th and Broadway, and my drink of choice was called Colt 45. And Stephanie's heard all my Colt stories, which I can't go into today. But so I came to Rockridge Fellowship kicking and screaming. I did not want to be condemned to being an alcoholic, because I grew up in a community that looked at alcohol as with a moral attitude towards it, moralistic. And but I was proud of who I was as growing up among people with, you know, in a respected family and so on. So I had, you know, incomprehensible demoralization, which led to depression, and I was drinking alone in my office, day after day, month after month, year after year. And when I was somehow managing it, when the sheriff put a lock on the door, that was my first wake-up call that something was, I was not managing right. So anyway, and so when I walked into Rockridge, they talked to me about alcoholism being a disease, and I saw people at Rockridge. I was coming to the 615 that were smiling and welcoming, and I said, well, how could these people be alcoholic? They're smiling, they're happy. And so I resisted step one and two for 30 days, 30 or more days, and I was drinking every day. And so when I finally turned myself over to the fellowship, which was my higher power, I started the sobriety on April 13th, 2013. And so I have a little over 3 years. And the other thing that I was talked to about was hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. And I had that recipe down. But I didn't put the words together, the incomprehensible demoralization. But I lived with that for years and years and years. So now I also resisted getting a sponsor. That was another thing that I because I felt like, well, I should be able to do this alone and on my own, but I couldn't. So I got a sponsor. I go to, you know, meetings almost every day. I did the 90 and 90, and after 60 days, I was at many, many meetings with Stephanie, the 6:15 meetings. It's called the Attitude Adjustment Meeting. If any of you want to try it out, you should come. So now I go to almost a meeting a day. I do a meditation meeting at 7:40 at Rockridge, like 3 or 4 days a week. And I have 2 weeks left in this country, and I'm so thrilled that I'll be going back to South Africa on the 31st of May, sober. And there's a ton of meetings there in Durban. We Googled AA, and so I'll be learning about some of the AA meetings there. So, 5 minutes? Okay. I should say that, you know, I'm of the atheist agnostic variety, and I did not get turned off by, you know, reference to God in our literature and the 12 steps. And I mentioned a few minutes ago that, you know, the fellowship became a higher power, and I've been attending the emotional sobriety meetings at the Berkeley Fellowship as well recently. And I feel that even though, and after 60 days, I don't know if I mentioned this, the compulsion to drink was lifted. And that was the first gift I got from AA. I recently, one of the guys who's just has about 30 days now at Rockridge. He says to me, you know, I can stop drinking. I can stay sober for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and then I just get bored, quote unquote bored. And you know, he says, oh, is this all there is to it? You know, and it's so he, and I talked to him about having a spiritual program, because for me it was very difficult until my sponsor explained to me what it means to have a spiritual program. And, you know, I was confused for a long time. I thought spirituality was a subset of religion, you know, and it's not necessarily the case. For me, spirituality is just relationships with other people. I found in AA that, you know, coming from a country with institutionalized racism, the apartheid, I grew up there until I was 23 years old. And I cannot find another arena other than the AA fellowship where these barriers are broken down. The racism, you know, and economic classes in generally in society. This is the, so far, this is the greatest equalizer that I've, you know, that I've come across. And, you know, people spend, I mean, companies spend millions of dollars on diversity programs, you know, for people, so people can get along, and this, we can get that here with free. It's a free program, except for contributions that are needed to keep the fellowships going. So I'm very glad that Guillermo, I have to thank Guillermo for introducing me to you guys. And but that's about it. Thank you.
I actually move while I walk, while I talk.
Okay.
Can you guys hear me? Does that work? Hi, you guys. I'm Lindsay. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lindsay.
And whew, I'm nervous. It's always an interesting time in one's life when somebody gets called to do something like this, right? I'm nervous because, man, I'm having a really hard time in my life, right? I'm going through a real rupture in my life, in my health, my business, my relationships, and I'm having a hard time. And, of course, that's when AA calls on me, right? AA is what saves my life, right? So it's good to be here, and thanks for asking. My sobriety date is September 22nd, 2001. I got sober when I was 22. And if you're new, my story, I drank a lot when I was young. I'm going to talk about going to high school and drinking. And if you're new and you're in this meeting, my best advice for you is to listen to what the similarities are. I remember the first time I got that, I was at a young person's meeting, and we were all like 22 or 23 in the meeting, and there was this old guy who was probably like 58. And at the end of the meeting, we're all holding hands, and he's like, I could never get sober. I've lost everything, and I have not much to go. And we're all sitting around going, oh my God, I got my whole life to go. I can't get sober. You know, it's like whatever the excuse is to not get sober, we're going to use it. Too young, too old, too whatever. You know, that's what this alcoholic mind does, you know. So I started drinking when I was about 12 years old. I grew up in Berkeley, and I got sent to live in Agoura Hills in Southern California. And I moved to Agoura Hills where every, like, lawn was the same, every hair was the same. They were, like, frilly little, you know, shorts with flowers around them. And I was not them at all. And so I found alcohol immediately. And what happened when I was younger, like what happened when I was drinking when I was younger, is like it was fun. Like rage came out. Like it was time to get this party fucking started, you know? It was like I look at these 12-year-olds now and I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like they are babies. But I thought I was tough. You know, I can remember the first night, you know, like going up in the hills with some boys, you know, sneaking out of the house and throwing up and you know, ending up in my bed of throw up and wanting to do it again. I think the second night I got caught, right? There was always consequences in my drinking from the very, very, very get-go, right? The second night went to a party of the older brothers of the boys we were hanging out with, and my dad came and picked us up, and I stuck my head out of the window the whole ride home so that he couldn't smell my breath. Of course, I got caught, right, you know? You know, so it was always like that. You know, by the time I was 13, I mean, in that first year of my drinking, like, you know, I had my stomach pumped. I ended up in the hospital, like, with a blood alcohol level of 0.38. You know, we had snuck into somebody's house and, like, pulled all this liquor and put it all together, right? And I almost died right away. And I remember the next day, and this is, like, what happened for the rest of my drinking. This isn't my first 6 months of drinking, right? It happened all the time. It was, like, the next day, I'm totally, you know, I've had the IVs taken out. I'm sick as can be. I'm at home. I'm in trouble. And my voice machine, with a machine back then, right? had like 5 messages on about how, like, I don't want to be friends with you anymore. You are not appropriate for me, and I can't believe you did that. And, you know, I was immediately shunned, you know, like that feeling of not belonging. And that happened a lot, you know. When I got sober that night that I got sober, it happened the night before too, right? I was dating this, like, cute boy, and of course, I did the same thing by drinking and carrying on and kicking and screaming. And he's like, not enough. I've got enough of you. You're not worth it, you know? I mean, it's a common theme. So when people, you know, for me, there was never having just one drink of alcohol. Like, I drank to get drunk, right? And there was always consequences. I mean, by the time I was 15... Let's see what happened. By the time I was 15, I had shaved my head into a mohawk. I had gotten sent to 2 boarding schools, got kicked out of 1. I'd been in 4 rehabs. They had taken away my shoelaces. They had taken away my belt, you know, and I thought I was pretty badass. Every like different rehab or every different place that I got sent to was like another notch in my belt. Like, I remember going to my first one, and I was like, cool, I get to learn how to study up to be this cool alcoholic, right? Like, I was such a chameleon back then, so uncomfortable in my skin that, like, I would go to rehab, and I knew I'd never see the people again, so I could steal, like, somebody's stories, you know, or steal their laugh or their music or the way they talked or, you know, like, it's like I was just picking up on, like, what other people, because I didn't know how to be, I didn't like who I was. You know, those first years of my drinking, I mean, it was so much fun. There was so much rage. We did like tagging and, you know, breaking into places and stealing, you know, and, every time it was just more, I don't know, it was just like this good feeling, this rage, you know, and my drinking wasn't always like that. That's why it's like my drinking changed along the way, you know, there's a couple of pivotal moments in my drinking. I mean, let's see what the pivotal moments. So I remember swearing off drinking, right? Being 15 years old, being like, I am going to stop drinking, right? And my rule was like, I was going to not drink alone, right? Like, you guys have made that, right? And 2 weeks later, right, I'm like, well, I can drink if I'm on the telephone with somebody, right? I can drink if the TV's on. Right? There was always, like, this control of my drinking, you know, trying to manage my drinking. Like, how much can I get away with? How much can I do, you know? Can I get that perfect buzz? Can I do some powdered alcohol so that I can drink more, you know? It's like, how can I manage this feeling that I really like? You guys know what it is, right? Like, when you have a few beers and, like, the sun's going down and it's, like, totally pink and the barbecue is on and your jokes are really funny and the birds are chirping and other people are funny and it feels good with that perfect buzz that, like, later in my drinking, like, never happened, right? You know, I was always seeking that place where I felt good inside because I didn't feel worthy or good. And the thing is that the more the things that I did, you know, whittled away at that, you know, like, I remember my mom sent the cops out after me after I'd run away for the umpteenth time. And you know, she's concerned. My mom was really sick, too, so she was frail and searching for me and sick. And I just put my middle fingers up in her face and said, fuck you, bitch. You know, like, how dare you try to tell me what to do? You know, those are the things that I did while drinking and drugging, you know. And the more the things that I did, you know, it was like the more that I felt like I needed more alcohol to kind of, you know, numb those feelings that I was feeling inside. So there's one moment when I was about, I think it was about 16 years old, and all my friends, again, like, I had became like the, I like to say I became the powdered alcohol dealer at, I was a, you know, powdered alcohol dealer. But, you know, I wasn't really a dealer because I was just selling to the boarding students at the high school, you know, because I was a day student, so I had a real captive audience. I wasn't, like, that cool, you know. But I wasn't very good, and, you know, all my friends, once again, the parents had been like, we don't want you to hang out with Lindsay anymore. Like, she's a bad influence. And, like, my friends were starting to see my behavior and not wanting to hang out. And so there I am, 16 years old, and I've just pissed dirty for another drug test, right? I can remember it exactly. I'm sitting on the doorstep of our home, and my dad's on one side, and the high school counselor is on the left-hand side. I'm about to get kicked out of college, and kicked out of high school, and my counselor is making me tell my dad about the drug test, or he will, right? That's the ultimatum. So I tell my dad, and my dad's crying and sobbing once again, and in this moment at 16 years old, right, I say, okay, I'm going to stop. Okay, I don't want to do this anymore. Right? Have you guys done that? I don't want to do this anymore, have that feeling. And so they actually give me another chance. They say, okay, we'll give you one more chance. And I tried. You know, I had been sent to AA from that first rehab from when I was 12 years old, 13 years old, 14 years old. I knew about AA, right? And actually, to tell you the truth, I met some of my best hookups and best drug dealers in these rooms. Mm-hmm. You just sit in the back and be like, you doing this thing? You believe this shit? I'm aware of you guys. No. So I knew of AA, right? And at 16 years old, I said, okay, I'm going to get sober. And they said, okay, I'll give you one more chance. And they patted me on the back and sent me on my way to a few AA meetings, right? And I'll tell you, that 6 months that I stayed sober, that year of being 16 years old and sober, was one of my worst years of my life. Right? Like, I remember walking home from school, and like it was a rural town I lived in at the time. It was Ojai in Southern California. I walked down the road, and like a car would come, and I jumped in the bushes because I was totally too scared for them to see who I was or what I was doing. Like, I was worried it was somebody at school, you know, but the sensitivity of being sober and what it was like was way too much for me. You know, and after all of these consequences of my drinking, the rehabs, of the bad behavior, the consequences, when I was 18 years old, do you know my dad poured me a glass of champagne to celebrate my 18th birthday? I mean, my dad is an educated man. He's a professor of law. He's a good man. I came from a good family, right? And he just had no idea. Neither did I. But he had no idea that I have this disease of alcoholism, that I need a solution to life to live sober. They all didn't know that. The principal that gave me another chance, the counselor, my dad, you know, they didn't know that I couldn't have one drink. They didn't know that I had this phenomenon of craving, this allergy of alcohol, that once I had one, I was going to get drunk. You know, they had no idea. You know, so that 6 months was one of the worst years of my life, and I didn't stay sober very long, right? Because what am I going to do? I'm going to go back and get drunk, because I have no way of dealing with life on life's terms, of being Lindsay in her body, you know. And I went back to drinking and drugging, and this is where it kind of gets bad, right? That my drinking, like this rage, didn't come out anymore. Right? It was no more anger. It was just sadness and misery. You know, like I couldn't get drunk enough. Like I didn't even know if I was going to get drunk or get smashed. Like there was no relative of what was going to happen when I was drinking. You know, and I would get drunk, and just the sadness would come out. I would start crying and kicking and screaming and carrying on and getting in fights over politics and, you know, stupid stuff. And you know, I was in, I went to university, you know, the last place. I mean, I was going to go, like, off with some hippie dread guy and follow the fish, you know, because Jerry was dead, and my parents forced me, and I took the last remaining college that accepted me, and went off to university, where things got really bad. Started hanging out with the baseball team, and they taught me about a beer wall. And so I had my whole dorm room covered in beer labels that I was really proud of. And had a balcony with piles of the bottles that you drink, you know, because we would change them for money. And, you know, I got caught so many times. I got minor possession. I got started getting in trouble with the law, you know, getting into bad situations with men. And almost got kicked out of the university again. And I had to go to AA. I got sent, you know, once again. I had to have this court papers go to this fucking thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I hated you guys. I really did. I thought you guys were a bunch of losers that didn't know how to control your drinking, you know. you know, and I remember even, like, going to a therapist and trying to tell them what was going on and, like, how I needed help. And, you know, I'd have those, like, moments of clarity where I need to change my life and do something, you know. I don't want to be like this. I don't want to live like this. And, you know, so I just continued to drink. And I'll tell you, when I got sober, it was no big bang. It was no, like, rock bottom horrible, you know. It really wasn't. And if you had told me that I would have 14 years and been through what I have been through on that day that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober, I think I would have been out of the fucking door in a heartbeat, you know. But that night, you know, I told you I was out with a cute boy and I was supposed to be the sober driver. And I argued with him for hours because I knew I wasn't going to do it. But he didn't get it, right? And so I was like, okay, I'm risking their lives, you know. And I love it when you guys laugh. Makes me feel so good. So there I was. I actually don't remember how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous the next morning or the next day. I really don't. I don't remember looking. I don't think there was the World Wide Web then. I don't know. But I don't remember, like, looking, figuring it out. I just remember going, and it was, like, the first time. I mean, I'd been to AA, you know, so many times, and I don't know why I spoke at this meeting, but I raised my hand, and I told them what happened with the boy the night before. And they just nodded and, you know, kept going around the room. And I'm like, that was my first day, you know, and I think that I just went because I was kind of lonely, you know, and alcohol wasn't working, and I didn't have any friends, you know. I was drinking alone, and I went just because I was lonely, but I stayed, and I stayed sober. And I'll tell you, I didn't do this thing, this Alcoholics Anonymous thing, perfectly. You know, you don't have to do it perfectly to stay sober, but I'll tell you, there's a moment in my sobriety where shit got good, and that's because I did what you guys suggested. So I didn't do that the first year of my sobriety, because I wasn't really officially here, right? I was sober, and I spent the next year sitting in the back of the room. This time I was living in San Francisco, and I was sitting in the back of the room, and I wasn't going to the same meeting twice. Because there's a lot of meetings in San Francisco, right? You can go to 100 and never go to the same one twice. And I didn't want to touch you. I didn't want to hold your hand. Like, I didn't want to say the Lord's Prayer. Like, I hated God. I mean, I knew there wasn't a God, you know? It's like, but I didn't want to be feeling the way that I was feeling again. So I white-knuckled it. And let me tell you again, that year, that first year of my sobriety, second worst year of my life. Right? Because I had no alcohol. I had nothing to cope with how it was to be inside Lindsay Miller. When I was drinking, when I got sober, I had a house with furniture and roommates, right? I got sober, and I was living in the basement out of a suitcase, and the futon I had bought, I had this big old box that I put over the windows so that you couldn't see inside, right? Because that's what it was like sober. That's how raw I was again. You know, I had nothing to cope, to deal with this. You know, and the anxiety and the hopelessness and the day-to-day, like, wake up and I want to fucking die. Right? There's hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. There really is. We don't have to wake up and feel that way anymore. I don't wake up. I'm going through the worst rupture of my life and I don't wake up and I don't want to die. You know, there's hope for me today. You know, there's hope for you today. And, you know, so don't do what I did, okay? I got a sponsor in a different town, right? I was working up in Napa, so I got my sponsor up in Napa while I was living in San Francisco. I met her for lunch. Right? It didn't work any of the steps. Right? Oh, my goodness. So things just got gradually worse. Gradually worse. And I once again, I can remember the day. I can remember the day. Some boyfriend had broken up with me. My world was coming apart, and I sat in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and cried, and actually spoke again, and I finally what happened was I got a sponsor. I moved to Napa and I got a sponsor in the town that I lived in, you know. And I can remember the day that I went and saw her for the first time. And she told me to bring the big book, the 12 and 12, a pad of paper, a highlighter, a pencil. And so I waddle in with all my stuff to her house. And out walks another sponsee, and then I walk in, right? And there's, like, doilies and candles. And, like, I feel like I'm in Bible school. Fuck me. And I sat on that couch in that day. And this is where my life changed. You know, I sat on that couch that day and I said, I said, I'm going to be honest. I'm saying this inside. I'm going to be honest to this lady today. I'm going to tell the truth. Now, I had been in rehabs and boarding schools. I mean, I had been, you know, in the court systems. I knew how to manipulate. I knew how to get people to tell me about them so that I could manipulate the situation later or get you to like me or whatever. And that day I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be honest with this lady about what's going on. And that's when my life changed. I had never been honest before, you know? So the first thing that I tell her, right, is I don't really think I'm an alcoholic. I really didn't. I mean, there was just this bunch of, you know, I knew there was a problem, right? Consequences every time that I drank. But, like, I was 22. And I could actually go a couple weeks without drinking, right? Like, I didn't go drunk and go on sprees forever like everybody talked about or the old fogies talked about in the meetings, right? Like, I could go periods of time. And she was so patient with me, right? She talked to me a lot about that. And she told me that there's two kinds of alcoholics. One who, once they start drinking, they can't stop, who go, you know, 6 months, a year, and can't stop drinking. And then there's the other kind, right? You guys know what this is. The second kind, you know, when you take a sip of alcohol, you have this feeling that you want another? Oh, yes. Now that I could relate to, right? I never wanted one drink. Once I had one drink, oh, we were having two, and then we were having three. There's this rise of anticipation for more, right? It happened tonight. I had a donut. I wanted another, right? That desire for more. Man, I thought about that donut all day long, too. I am still an alcoholic. But that I could understand, right? I could understand, and the words started making sense, that was a phenomenon of craving. That's what craving was, that desire for more. Or when there wasn't any, like I had this obsession where I would think about how I could get more. Now that I knew, right? I spent a lot of time trying to get more. And so I was well on my way, you know, and I told her many things. You know, the next thing that I had to get over was I definitely didn't believe in God. You know, I was a spitfire atheist. Like, I actually knew that there wasn't a God. Just look at my past. Like, there wouldn't be any God, you know, if you had a past like mine. You know, and so she, just like you, you know, talked about, well, you know, is your way working? And I said, no. She says, well, do you think that there might be a solution here in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I was like, yeah. And she said, do you think it might work for you? And I said, maybe. You know, that was actually the scary part, was I actually really didn't think that it was going to work for me. You know, it would work for you, it would work for you and you and you. But I was a piece of shit. Like that was pretty scary, that this was the last place to go and it might not work for me. Right, because now I'm starting to want it. Right, I'm starting to want this thing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm starting to desire the joy that you guys have in your eyes. And now I'm scared that it's not going to work for me, you know. And thank God for this woman, because it was her belief that it would work for me that allowed me to stay here and stay sober and keep in this thing of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so you don't have to believe in God to be here. You know, just have to believe that there might be a solution. You know, and you have to believe it works for you. You just stay. You know, be willing to do what we ask of you. So at this time, I start living in a sober living home, right, with like 10, 15 other alcoholics. I'm starting to work the steps. You guys are starting to fuck up my misery, right? 15 alcoholics. Oh, my God, that was a crazy nightmare. I get this commitment at the Friday noon meeting. I'm the speaker getter, right? And so the noon meeting was the only meeting that I felt comfortable going in it, because it took me a long time before I could, like, look you in the eyes or hold your hands or anything like that. And the only meeting that I felt comfortable going to was the noon meeting, because there was newcomers and old-timers and nobody cool, right? Sweet. Yeah. And so I was the speaker getter, and this became my meeting. like, I started feeling comfortable at it because I knew you and I knew you and I knew you. And if you were new, I knew you. And I started feeling comfortable in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was because of service, right? So now I have recovery, I have service. And there was two other young people in Napa, two girls, and I became friends. So now I had two friends, now I had fellowship. So I got these things start working in my life, right? I got service, I got fellowship, I got recovery. Start doing the steps, I do an inventory. Oh, that sucked. But I got it off my back, right? And now I knew what you guys were talking about, and I was a part of this thing, right? I wasn't an outsider. I mean, when I first got sober that first year, like, I stole the big book from the Alano Club and read it in my basement because I was too embarrassed to tell you that I didn't know what I was doing or tell you that I didn't have a book, right? So now I'm a part of. I'm doing the four step, you know, going to dances. Oh, my God, my first dance. It was a nightmare. These two girls ditched me and I to go to Taco Bell, and I stood against the wall like a wallflower, like scared shitless. I did not talk to them the whole ride home. Right? I think we didn't talk for weeks. My two friends, sober friends. So the next dance that we have, you know, like, I have a commitment. I am like the ticket giver. And that dance isn't so bad. That dance is kind of fun. And then the next dance, I'm like the DJ host chick. And I'm owning this dance. I'm feeling comfortable. I'm starting to get into it, you know. And we start forming this thing called YPAW in Napa, right? And we start getting into young people and going out and going to other young people. And I'm starting to feel comfortable. I went on a date, you know. I danced. I started to do the deal and feeling a little comfortable. I bought a pizza all myself. I had such a hard time with that. Like, I had no idea what the toppings should be, you know? And then I start doing the steps, you know, and start doing the amends. And that's really when shit changed for me, right? I made amends to my parents, made amends to my dad. I remember one of my amends, I gave my amends, and she was like, Lindsay, I just remember when the darkness, when your lightness just went away and darkness just fell over. You know, and I walked away from these amends like throwing away bits and pieces of garbage, right, of all the things that I had done bad. And I'd been scared of doing those amends. Now, we take amends seriously here. You don't rush out and do them, right? We had to talk through every single one, right? Like, should I make amends? Do I need to make amends? What is harm? Did I cause harm? You know, what does it mean? And then to learn that all I had to do was say, I'm sorry. I mean, to say that I was wrong. Like, how can I make it right? Those vocabularies, I had no idea how to do that. It's so simple. That was wrong of me. I didn't treat you with the integrity and dignity you deserved. Is there anything I can do to make up for you? Wow, that is, like, somehow I miss growing up, you know. And I started throwing away garbage off, you know, out of Lindsay. And I started getting to know who I was. And you know, I remember my first spiritual experience. Well, the first one was I actually held hands with you. That was a big spiritual experience, right? But my second spiritual experience was, I remember driving home from a meeting, and I'm driving in the car, and I got the windows rolled down, and it's like this pink moment, and it's beautiful, and the music's on, the birds are chirping, and like, it's just a moment of peace. It's just like, nothing's wrong here. Huh. It's okay. And then it's gone, right? But it lasted just a second. A little bit of relief from the craziness of being Lindsay. And, you know, thank goodness for that part in the big book. You know, it talks about it in the back that there's no burning bushes for everybody. There's just small spiritual experiences of varying, I forget the line, you know, but of different degrees, you know, because that was my way of growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, is these little personality changes that were totally sufficient to, like, revolutionary my whole existence, you know. So, man, you know, I can't say that those three things have had to continue in my whole sobriety: service, unity, and recovery. I've needed all of those things to stay sober, and that's where, like, the joy has sung. Right? Like, when I'm sponsoring people, I'm in service, I'm, you know, doing recovery, and, You know, I, you know, my life has taken me so many places. I remember at 3 years sober, you know, like I went skipping off. I got the dream, the photojournalist dream of my life, you know, to go to Arizona and work for the Arizona Daily Star and be a photographer and cover the border, you know. And I got to do that, you know, and I got to do that sober with God, you know, skipping hand in hand as I was going, you know, like shit got good. You know, and then I got to Tucson. You know, and I am so welcoming to people who just move to places, because when you move to place and you're not a newcomer, it's hard. You know, it's hard, you know. And people say the newcomer is the most important person in the meeting, but so are the fucking visitors, man. You know? And we got really into young people, and I could have a lot of service things that I'd like to talk about, but there were so many things, and this one in particular, I remember, let me skip that one. I don't have much time. At 5 years sobriety, right, you know, like I said, like, things got really good, and at 5 years of sobriety, like, things stopped working, right? Shit got bad. Like, I kind of wanted to blow my brains out. You know, I was really into young people, and young people is the coolest place to be. I can't tell you, like, young people has saved my life. And, but at 5 years of sobriety, you know, shit went down in young people. And, because my higher power had become you guys, because that's what I was willing to open the door to be, was that this group of alcoholics was my higher power. And in 5 years sober, you guys let me down. Rightly so, you're a group of drunks, right? But my higher power had to grow. And at 5 years sober, things, that rough time where I wanted to blow my brains out was because I had to open that door wider. It had to be bigger. And thank you. And I actually had to, you know, leave the meetings that I was going to and start going to different meetings. I had to grow up in a different way. I had to trust in a higher power and not people. You know, I think that's what's happening for me today, too. You know, today, you know, that rupture of 5 years sober led me to, like, creating my own business and creating a successful company where I started flying all around the world. Like, people were hiring me in all different places, like Paris and Bali and all these places, and I was getting flown all over the world. I mean, you know, this drunk who was so scared to look you in the eyes, you know, got to create this dream of life where I got to do these amazing things, you know, and that's just as scary for me than when shit hits the fan. You know, I was really scared to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you how good things were. Things got good because of you, because you guys have taught me, you know, how to show up, how to suit up, how to write a checkbook, how to be responsible, how to do the things that I'm going to say that I'm going to do. You guys taught me all of that. You know, and then this season of my life, you know, I got really sick. My body gave out on me. You know, my health gave out. So then the business went. Then my relationship went. And right now I feel stripped of everything that I have wrestled satisfaction out of. Because I'm still left with that ism, right? I'm still left with that desire for more, for creating a feeling myself because of what is happening out here. And that's not where the relief lies, right? That's not where serenity lies. You know, and I did. I have been stripped and taken away of the things that have that I have called Lindsay, you know. And like, I just get to allow a new being to emerge, just like when I got sober. I don't know who she is. You know, I can't domineer my life anymore. I can't go out there and force and make money. I can't, you know, I can't do those things anymore. It's like a new way of being, you know. And so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous because you guys teach me how to do that, how to surrender the things that aren't working, you know, the character defects that I've chosen to, you know, I've chosen to dabble in and get some satisfaction out of, you know. And this is the place that I go. And you know, in the last few years, which is really, really also really cool, is that I've gone to other places too. You know, I've opened my eyes to other, you know, religions and other places where I can see how other people have done it, you know. I used to have such judgment of them, you know, like an Alcoholics Anonymous, we have it. Like, I used to think that we were, like, had it better than everybody else, you know, and that's been stripped away too, you know. I get to see, how do you do it? How have you done, you know, your life and never picked up alcohol? How do you do that? You know, and, you know, so my relationship with myself, my relationship with my higher power, my relationship to forgiveness is all, you know, changing and growing. And today, even though this like morning I was crying for 45 minutes, you know, it's like I'm saying yes to it. There's richness in this. I know that there's more on the other side because I've seen it in my past and in my being and in my own story and sharing it tonight. That this rupture, this time in our lives where like everything falls apart, you know, there was this poster in the Alana Club where I got sober. And I used to love it because I would sit there, you know, in the back and cry. And it was this twig that was hanging over a cliff. And there was a kitty hanging over it, you know, clawing, hanging in there. And on the top of the thing, it said, "Hang in there, baby." You know, and that got me through, you know, just hang in there. And that's what I feel like. I'm just hanging in, just hanging on to sobriety, you know, just hanging here, you know, just one day at a time, being in today one step at a time. So anyway, that's enough out of me. Thank you.